Disc 5. The introductions begin at Govinda's right, so there are a bunch of people ahead of me, including Curtis. The person on my immediate right is a portly, wheelchair-bound gentleman in his early 50s, and from the few words we exchange, I get the impression that he attends church basement functions pretty indiscriminately, especially during summer reruns. He, Barry, has a battered penguin Gita in front of him. In fact, everyone but me and Curtis has a Gita in front of them, mostly penguins, a few Stephen Mitchells, one I recognize as being from the Theosophical Society, and a variety of others. The introductions continue. Melanie is a customer service rep who is very curious and always interested in new things. Rohan enjoys exploring the beauty of other cultures, though he looks pretty Hindu and I suspect he's a Gita ringer. Kurt is trying to practice the lessons of the Gita in his own life. Max is one of those disorienting people without clear gender markings and says something about service and duty. There's a gay couple, a straight couple, a Hispanic guy with prison tats, a few Hindus and New Agers. About half the people around the table seem like sincere students who want to get more from the Gita. The other half, who knows? As the introductions continue, sap, dullard, misanthrope Curtis is just grinning away, his bright, beaming smile welcoming each and all into his ever-expanding embrace. A Folger's coffee can with a rectangular slot cut in the plastic lid is being passed around to help pay for the use of the basement. By the time it's Curtis's turn to introduce himself, my eyes have come loose in my head. My head loose on my shoulders, and my ass loose on my chair. I'm here with my new friend, Mac, says Curtis, and I don't really know what a Baghdad Gita is, but I feel you're all a very special, sincere group of people, and I'm very happy to be here with you. They applaud Curtis's comments. My hands reflexively start to clap, but I command them to stillness. Where did I go wrong? The universe has turned on me. It's my turn to say hello. I start oozing out of my chair. Hi, I mumble. One of my hands gives a little wave, the traitor. Just want to go where the knowledge is, says I with a small laugh, shared by none. Me and my friend... I can't remember if we came up with a code name for Curtis, so that I was about to blow his cover. But by stumbling on his name, it sounds to my ears like a gay white guy going to Gita study with his young black stud, and I start giggling. I only manage to say, "Thanks for having us. Hope to learn a lot." When the coffee can comes to me, I conspicuously stuff a wad of bills into it as if to redeem myself, though probably only making myself seem somehow more unhinged. This brain-dead stunt will haunt me later when it comes time to pay the cabbie. Once the introductions are done, Govinda asks us all to turn to the fourth discourse. Noticing that Curtis and I don't have books, he asks our neighbors to share with us. My wheelchair guy turns his penguin grudgingly toward me, the good student made to suffer for the bad. I pretend to carefully read the open page with an air of scholarly appreciation to satisfy him. In the movie The Matrix, there's a scene where the adept Morpheus effortlessly glides through throngs of people on a bustling city sidewalk, while inept Neo bumbles and collides and apologizes, flow and non-flow, having no preferences, having no ego that requires constant monitoring and reinforcing, having a calm, untroubled mind. Most of my life resembles Morpheus's smooth navigation, rather than Neo's manic pinball mode. When that flow is disrupted, even in a small way, I am acutely aware of it. I stop what I'm doing until I find the obstruction that caused the error. I make sure my breathing is deep and stable, my mind clear, and get myself back to the place of smooth, effortless functioning. The error itself doesn't matter so much as eradicating or circumnavigating the source of the error. When something impedes flow, returning to smooth flow is the objective, not making a study of obstructions. Everyone navigates in this higher mode to one degree or another, and anyone can learn to do it better and more often. Actually, most people would function a lot more smoothly and easily, a lot more of the time, if they just learn to breathe correctly. Practically everyone restricts their breathing to the upper part of the lungs, so that the chest expands and not the belly. The result of this shallow breathing is that we operate in a perpetual panic mode, as if all of life was a fight-or-flight situation. This causes the mental state of dis-ease that we accept as normal, and from which we seek escape through addictions and distractions. It disrupts our activity during the day and our rest at night. When we breathe into our entire lungs by expanding the diaphragm, we automatically create a mental state of composure and ease, which is then reflected in our environment. How telling is it that we are a society of people who don't even know how to breathe? Hello! At what more basic level could we possibly fail? And what's more than that, how telling is it that when we are made aware of this crippling flaw, most of us will do absolutely nothing to correct it, because our vanity won't allow us to expand our tummies? My brain is sludge. I never suffer from the other maladies that might cause one to be in discord with the energetic flow of things, so not being tired is really all I have to worry about. And today I botched it, and my world has spun off its axis as a result. Wrong is right, I know, and there's a reason for everything, even this. But adopting a philosophical outlook doesn't make it any more pleasant. Govinda begins reading from his Gita, and I can barely distinguish one word from another. Curtis is practically snuggling with the pretty co-ed on his left, with whom he's sharing a book. Govinda gets about a minute into his reading when he stops and looks at me, as do most of the others. Am I drooling? You okay? Asks Curtis in a whisper. Yes, I say slowly, wondering why all eyes are on me. I revisit the last few moments in my mind and come to suspect that a groan I thought was internal might have found voice. Is there something you'd like to add? Asks Govinda. Excuse me, I've forgotten your name. So have I. I look at Curtis. Mac, he whispers. Mac, I tell Govinda. You don't sound like you agree with the words of Lord Krishna, Mac. I'm sure we'd all be very interested in your comments, if you'd care to share them with us.
Well, not really, no.
Thank you. Sorry. Please go on. Okay, Govinda says, and returns to the part where Krishna tells Arjuna that he's showing him his universal form, because Arjuna is such a devoted pal. I make a bathroom sound on the mental plane, and am startled to hear it manifest on the physical plane as well. Govinda stops and turns to me. Please, Mac, if you have anything to say. The great master attended a class disguised as a lowly student. The inept teacher held up the great book and spoke words that were loathsome to the great master's ears. Unable to endure the inept teacher's false interpretation of the great book any longer, The great master picked up his chair and beat the inept teacher to death. Instantly, the lowly students burst into full enlightenment. The Zen teachings of Master Addlebrain. "He's lying," I blurt. Blurting is one of the negative effects of being tired for me. I speak when I otherwise wouldn't and say things I probably shouldn't. "Who's lying, Mac? Lord Krishna?" "Yes, Lord Krishna. Lying. I'm sorry, really. Please, just go ahead. I'll be good." "It's okay, Mac. I think the Lord can handle a little constructive criticism." That gets a laugh from the group. I look at Curtis. He shrugs slightly as if to say, "Why not?" "Yeah, why not?" "He's not the Lord," I say. "That just confuses things. You can't make any sense of the Gita if you don't understand who's who." Govinda laughs a little nervously. "Lord," he says, holding up the cover of his book for me to see, "the song of the Lord. The Bhagavad Gita is the story of how the Lord reveals his full glory to his devotee." "Yuck," I blurt. "No, it's not. You're making it a Christian thing. It's not a Christian thing, or a Hindu thing, or anyone else's thing. It's like the coolest thing in the world, and you're just breezing right past it. You're not getting what a fun and important thing this really is." There's a reason for me to be in this sorry place, in this sorry state. I feel like I'm stuck in the role of a proselytizer, which is the last thing I want to be. If I had to guess, I'd say that one person in this room was on the verge of something, and so my unlikely and reluctant presence has been orchestrated for that one person's benefit, to help them take the next step. Just a guess, of course, but the setup is so clumsy that it has to be something along those lines. Time, perhaps, will tell. "Look for yourself," I say. "Look at what Krishna just told Arjuna. I'm showing you all this because you're my friend and devotee. Even accounting for sloppy translations, that's not true. Krishna is obviously lying. The question is, why? Why is Krishna lying?" I'm getting a lot of dirty looks. I made a heresy. Oops. I guess you can't come to Friday night Gita study in Queens and call the Blessed Lord a big fat liar. I stand up and touch Curtis's shoulder. "Look, I'm sorry. You're right. I don't know what I'm saying. We have to go. We were just supposed to meet someone." "Please stay, Mac," says Govinda, gesturing to my seat. "If you have a theory about Lord Krishna that we haven't considered, I think that's the purpose of this group, to consider different viewpoints and decide for ourselves." He looks around the group for support and doesn't get much. "Please, stay. Continue." I'm so fatigued, I'm about to start blubbering. I've somehow wandered out of the sunlight and into this dreary underworld. I'm trapped in this absurd role on this shabby stage, and it looks like the only way out is straight through. There's nothing to do but play it out. I take a breath and try to establish some degree of clarity. "Okay." I sit back down so as not to appear to be competing for the leadership role with Govinda. "Krishna is lying. Krishna is not revealing himself to Arjuna for the reasons he states." Govinda appears bemused by my presumptuousness. "So why is Lord Krishna lying, Mac?" He still has the condescending lilt in his voice, but I don't mind. "You've been studying the Gita for 15 years, Govinda, so you already know why he's lying. He wants something. What does Krishna want? Why is he really talking to Arjuna?" Govinda doesn't look happy to have the tables turned on him, and I didn't really mean to do it, but here we are. He wants Arjuna to get back up, replies Govinda. He wants him to blow the conch and launch the war. Of course. So it's not really true that Krishna has chosen this time and place, seated between two massive armies poised to attack, to reward friendship and devotion, is it? Well, you can look at it from the perspective. Don't make excuses for the Gita, Govinda. Like you say, it can stand a little constructive criticism, but maybe some interpretations can't. In any event, the point is that Krishna doesn't matter. It's not about Krishna. That doesn't concern us here. Okay, Mac, says Govinda with a look of gentle encouragement. What does matter? What does concern us here? Why did Arjuna fall down? I ask. Govinda doesn't miss a beat. Arjuna fell down because he saw his own beloved teachers and relatives among the opposing army, and he realized that no amount of wealth or glory could make the slaughter of his beloved... No, no, I interrupt. Don't waste your time on that. That's just the story, the metaphor. How did I get drawn into this? Where's the damned exit? That's the little story of Arjuna and Krishna on the battlefield. We don't care about that. This isn't a story about foreign people in an ancient culture clashing for a throne. It's all about the reader. Nothing else. That's why this book matters. It's not about the people in the story. It's all about the person reading the story. I say this to Govinda, but then turn to everyone seated around the tables. It's not theory. It's practice. It's about you, your life, right now, this very minute. You should be taking this book very personally. You, the reader, are Arjuna. This is your war. The Bhagavad Gita is about why Arjuna gets back up and launches the war. But you can't understand why he got back up until you understand why he fell, which, no offense, none of you do. Tired or not, once I get going, I can't stop until the idea I'm trying to express is fully expressed. When you see for yourself what Arjuna saw, the sight that made the world's mightiest warrior collapse in fear and confusion, you'll do exactly what he did, collapse in fear and confusion, and you'll be unable to give the signal to launch the war. Until that happens to you, it's all theoretical, irrelevant. Until you see what Arjuna saw firsthand in your own life, the Gita is of no more value to you than a book of scribble. The Bhagavad Gita begins when Arjuna falls, and then it's all about one thing and one thing only. Why did Arjuna get back up? I pause. The idea seems fully expressed. The end is in sight. Sorry, really. I'm almost finished. The Gita isn't some sterile intellectual pursuit. It's the great, rollicking, swashbuckling adventure of life, truth, reality, freedom, the real treasures. And it doesn't matter whether you're in a wheelchair, or you're young or old, rich, poor, guy, girl, Jewish, Shinto, whatever. It's beyond all that. But it's not a book you read. It's a journey you take. And it's not Arjuna's journey. It's yours. I stand up and grab Curtis by the arm. Okay, that's it. Sorry to spout off like such a dreadful idiot. Hope I didn't ruin everyone's evening. Gotta go. Bye. We flee. This seems to be a recurring theme lately, so I guess it's something I'm supposed to pay attention to and talk about. Curtis brings me letters people have written about Damnedest, and one thing many of the letters have in common is that the writers are making the book about something besides themselves, as if Damnedest was about the characters in the book, rather than the character reading it. Then Curtis expresses his interest in the hero's journey, Campbell, Star Wars, and all that, but stays in the role of the audience member, not seeing or being shown that life is not a spectator's sport, that the hero of his life is him, and the journey is his to make. Now again, this Gita group, and I see that one reason I was guided into that quaggy weirdness was to show me this thing again, this quality that affords us the cuddly illusion that life is somehow elsewhere or elsewhen, somehow other than right here and right now. We are, many of us, not merely living in a dream, but asleep within it. And here I'll say that the usual disclaimers apply. There is no right and wrong, no better or worse. Truth isn't good and delusion isn't evil. No one is ahead or behind. The worms won't care how your epitaph reads, and the truth of you will outlive time itself. All is vanity. All. Chapter 18. Why Arjuna Fell. My members fail. My tongue dries in my mouth. A shudder thrills my body, and my hair bristles with horror. From my weak hands slips Gandiv, the goodly bow. A fever burns my skin to parching. Hardly may I stand. The life within me seems to swim and faint. Nothing do I foresee save woe and wail. It is not good, O Kashav. Not of good can spring from mutual slaughter. Lo, I hate triumph and domination, wealth and ease. Thus sadly won. Oho, what victory can bring delight, Govinda? What rich spoils could profit? What rule recompense? What span of life itself seems sweet, bought with such blood? Arjuna, Bhagavad Gita. Julie is about to see for herself what no book or teacher could possibly show her. She's about to know, directly, in her own life, what the price of truth is everything really means. For some people, this particular stage of the process is easier. For some, it's harder. Some people have had years to soften to it and slip more or less comfortably into it. Some, like Julie, hit it hard, without warning or preparation, and have a worse time of it than can be expressed by words on the page. This is where people can end up straitjacketed, as does Ahab, or worse.
I'm so scared at times, I'm practically frozen. Frozen with fear. Literally sick with fear. What else is up here? Even the air seems too heavy to move. There are parts of this attic I can't even see into. I can make out large forms, menacing shapes, huge, immovable, dark objects. There are no demons but these. I now know. But some of these demons I love. That's the scariest thing. They are me. But they're not. But they are. My mother is up here. My father is here. My music, pets, dreams, family, friends. It's not all bleak and horrible. There are moments, magic, love, beauty, poems, flowers, songs, boys and men I've loved, my teachers, you, Jed, the places and smells and friends from my childhood. There seems to be no end. There's so much. I've lived a beautiful, lovely, blessed life. What do I do? It's not just junk. It's not all bad. This is the scariest part of all. What about the good? Friends, love, dance, my heart. Isn't all that real? Aren't these memories real? Isn't my heart real? What of that? What?
This isn't where the battle is fought. This is where the battlefield is first fully apprehended. The person who arrives at this point is not the person who goes beyond. In this process, resistance is conquered, and non-resistance takes its place. Acceptance, recognition, surrender. The segregated self is slain, and the integrated self is born. Death and resurrection, caterpillar and butterfly, human and vampire. To the onlooker, it looks like one becomes the other. But to the participant, it is quite unmistakably the end of one thing and the beginning of another.
I try to summon the courage to focus on one thing, my mother. I can hardly do it. I don't even understand what her presence here is really composed of. But it seems like mother is a ridiculously inadequate term for countless thousands, millions of bits and pieces of emotions of varying intensities, memories, images. Not my mother, of course, but all somehow related to her, coming from her, feeling like her. Fears, images, scraps of sound, memories, hopes, some pleasant, some oppressive. Money is another one. Money and security. I thought I was level-headed when it came to money, spiritually tuned and well-balanced. But what I really am is infested by it like a cancer that is silently metastasized into every organ and tissue. Amazing. Just amazing. It's everywhere. And it's so foul and putrid and fear-infected that I'm sickened to think of it. And the thing is, I was level-headed when it came to money. What does this infection look like in those I always scorned for their love of money, or in those I pitied for their enslavement to it? It makes me ill to even think about it. You talk about icebergs, Jed, the larger mass that hides beneath the surface. But this reminds me more of the mushrooms I once wrote a piece about. Most people think the blue whale is the largest living thing on Earth, but it's actually the honey mushroom, which, as I recall, can spread its underground root system over more than 2,000 acres. You would hardly suspect, by seeing the visible portion that grows above ground, that it stretches for miles in all directions and can actually wipe out forests. This is what the sickness of money has made me think about, as I've discovered its vast and pernicious root system. The way it's fairly small and benign in its visible aspect, and so vast and devastating below. One thing I am beginning to see is that nothing is really a thing apart. Everything is intertwined and forms part of something larger, and something larger than that, some energetically interconnected labyrinth of self. This is the complexity of the fabric of self, and the threads don't run in neat lines, but in chaotic, multidimensional, swirling patterns, some visible, some deep and unseen. This is my addict. This is my tapestry, my fabric. The fabric is me, but I am not its weaver. Looked at as a whole, it seems to represent me, but as soon as I get close and see what it's really made up of, and distinguish the component patterns, the millions of threads, then I disappear. And all that remains is a haphazard patchwork of memories and emotions. That's what I am. That's all I am.
Resist this process with a rigid ego, and it will break you. I don't personally know of anyone committing suicide at this juncture, but I suppose it's not uncommon. Julie certainly considered it. You can't not. In this situation, can't go forward, can't go back, death is the tertium quid, the third thing. It might well have been that very thought, the thought of death, that opened her to the necessary letting go, itself a kind of death. In fact, many or even most suicides might take place right here, which will seem more plausible as we get a better idea of where right here really is. That exact point, the point where the person who fell becomes the person who gets back up, is the exact line of division between two beings. Ego may desire enlightenment, but ego can't cross that line. The person who stands up is not the person who fell. It's the primary death-birth process, and nothing proceeds until it happens. Julie is learning the one thing about the Bhagavad Gita that no amount of studying and dedication could ever reveal. She's about to see what you can only see by approaching your own battlefield. She's about to see what Arjuna saw. She's about to see why Arjuna fell.
I don't know what I've gotten myself into. This is too much. It can't be done. What a fool I am to have started this. What a pathetic fool. How could I let this happen? Where does this go? There is no doubt I am the stupidest, stupidest person. This is bad. This will kill me. This is the end of me. No way back, no way through. There's no way I can ever do this. I don't know how anyone can. No one can. No one could ever choose this. Not me. Not me. This is something for a whole different kind of person. I don't even know what kind. It can't be done. I can't do it. I wish I had never started this. I just want to be back the way I was. I can't breathe. My insides are twisted. This is horror. This is so far beyond me. My soul is sick to death, and my heart is crushed.
At this point, Julie is catching her first glimpse of what's really going on. She hasn't started the battle yet, but she's coming to see what the battle truly entails. She's beginning to see where the battlefield really is, what the battlefield really is. She is beginning to see what anyone who comes to this will see, that it's not the dark, evil, noxious stuff that's the problem. It's not the ignorance or the sin. It's not the stuff we can't identify or the stuff we didn't know was there. What Julie is beginning to see is the same thing that drove Arjuna, the world's greatest warrior, to drop his weapon and crumple to the ground in fear and confusion when he saw it. And that the great monster is indomitable, you will yet have reason to know. Herman Melville. All attachments to the dream state are made of energy. That energy is called emotion. All emotions, positive and negative, are attachments. Humans are emotion-based creatures, and all emotions derive their energy from one core emotion: fear. Fear cannot be confronted or slain because it is fear of nothing, of no self. The desire to slay fear is itself a fear-based emotion. Fear can only be surrendered to. The thing feared entered. You can spend your life hacking away at the million-headed hydra of attachment and never make any progress. Or you can follow emotional energy back to its source, its lair, and see Leviathan, enemy of light, for what it really is: your heart. That's what Arjuna saw. That's why Arjuna fell. Chapter 19. Come, Ahab's compliments to ye. Ahab's soliloquy after rallying the crew, from chapter 37, Sunset. The prophecy was that I should be dismembered, and I lost this leg. I now prophesy that I will dismember my dismemberer. Herman Melville, Moby Dick. The cabin, by the stern windows, Ahab sitting alone and gazing out.
I leave a white and turbid wake, pale waters, paler cheeks, where'er I sail. the envious billows sidelong swell to whelm my track. Let them, but first I pass. Yonder, by ever-brimming goblet's rim, the warm waves blush like wine. The gold brow plumbs the blue. The diver sun, slow-dived from noon, goes down. My soul mounts up. She wearies with her endless hill. Is then the crown too heavy that I wear, this iron crown of Lombardy? Yet is it bright with many a gem. I, the wearer, see not its far flashings, but darkly feel that I wear that, that dazzlingly confounds. 'Tis iron, that I know, not gold. 'Tis split, too, that I feel. The jagged edge galls me so. My brain seems to beat against the solid metal. I, steel skull, mine, the sort that needs no helmet in the most brain-battering fight.
Dry heat upon my brow? Oh, time was when, as the sunrise nobly spurred me, so the sunset soothed. No more. This lovely light, it lights not me. All loveliness is anguish to me, since I can ne'er enjoy. Gifted with the high perception, I lack the low. Enjoying power, damned, most subtly and most malignantly, damned in the midst of paradise. Good night, good night. Waving his hand, he moves from the window. 'Twas not so hard a task. I thought to find one stubborn at the least, but my one cogged circle fits into all their various wheels, and they revolve. Or, if you will, like so many anthills of powder, they all stand before me, and I their match. Oh, hard, that to fire others, the match itself must needs be wasting. What I've dared, I've willed, and what I've willed, I'll do. They think me mad. Starbuck does, but I'm demoniac. I am madness maddened, that wild madness that's only calm to comprehend itself. The prophecy was that I should be dismembered, and I lost this leg. I now prophesy that I will dismember my dismemberer. Now, then, be the prophet and the fulfiller one. That's more than ye great gods, ever were. I laugh and hoot at ye cricket players, ye pugilists, ye deaf Burkes and blinded Bendigos. I will not say as schoolboys do to bullies, take someone of your own size, don't pommel me. No, ye've knocked me down, and I am up again. But ye have run and hidden. Come forth from behind your cotton bags. I have no long gun to reach ye. Come, Ahab's compliments to ye. Come and see if ye can swerve me. Swerve me? Ye cannot swerve me, else ye swerve yourselves. Man has ye there. Swerve me? The path to my fixed purpose is laid with iron rails, whereon my soul is grooved to run, over unsounded gorges, through the rifled hearts of mountains, under torrents' beds, unerringly I rush. Naught's an obstacle, naught's an angle to the iron way. Chapter 20. Why Arjuna Got Back Up. The soul that with a strong and constant calm takes sorrow and takes joy indifferently, lives in the life undying. That which is can never cease to be. That which is not will not exist. To see this truth of both is theirs who part essence from accident, substance from shadow. Indestructible, learn thou, the life is spreading life through all. It cannot anywhere, by any means, be anywise diminished, stayed, or changed. But for these fleeting frames which it informs, with spirit deathless, endless, infinite, they perish. Let them perish, prince, and fight. He who shall say, lo, I have slain a man. He who shall think, lo, I am slain. Those both know not. Life cannot slay. Life is not slain. Never the spirit was born. The spirit shall cease to be never. Never was time, it was not. End and beginning are dreams. Krishna, Bhagavad Gita. I'm sitting at the outdoor dining table on the upper deck, shaded by its tilted umbrella, with several books and a collection of handwritten notes spread out in front of me. Curtis is inside, working on the laptop in the office. So when the doorbell rings, both indoors and through an outdoor speaker, I assume he'll take care of it, which is wrong because it rings again a minute later. I guess I'll get that, he shouts. A minute later, Curtis leads Govinda through the French doors. Govinda starts to speak, but I cut him off. Have a seat, I say. Here, I indicate a drink tray. Pour yourself an iced tea. He sits down and pours his drink, without adding sugar, I notice. He has that frail body and blanched pallor one sees in health food stores and wherever cheeseburgers and sunlight are shunned. Listen to this, I say. Ego non baptizo, ti in nomine patris, sed in nomine diaboli, deliriously howled Ahab, as the malignant iron scorchingly devoured the baptismal blood. I baptize you not in the name of the Father, but in the name of the devil. Have you read Moby Dick? Govinda looks a bit disoriented, which is fine. I'm sure he's given plenty of thought to what he'd say to me when he got here, and we'll get to that. But I want to introduce him to my way of conducting a dialogue right from the beginning. Yeah, in high school, he answers. Cliff Notes, anyway, or maybe I saw the movie. Who's baptizing who? Ahab is baptizing his newly forged harpoon in blood, welded together like glue from the melted bones of murderers. Rock and roll, eh? My grin is probably a bit fiendish, and Govinda is probably wondering if he's made a big mistake by coming here. Maybe he has. My grin isn't for his benefit. I just really enjoy the chapter where Ahab creates his weapon, and I've been bursting to share it with someone all morning. Sounds kind of satanic, he replies. Yeah, I agree. Sure does. Melville told Nathaniel Hawthorne that that was the book's motto. I don't know if you remember... How could I forget? Govinda, nice to see you. Did you cover this in high school? Cover what? Why the book's motto seems satanic. I doubt it. You're probably surprised to see me again. Not really. I was pretty much expecting someone from that night. Makes sense that it's you. Oh, he says. So what happened after we left? Was everyone dazzled by my supreme wisdom? Mostly they thought you were drunk. Understandable. Let's go for a walk. You up for it? Come on. Oh, he says again. Okay, yeah, sure. We head into the house where I grab a Mets cap and my wallet and slip on some good walking sandals. I'm a bit energetically buzzed from the excitement of diving down through the layers of Moby Dick, so a walk will be a good way to expend the build-up. We hop in the Jeep and drive a couple of miles to a boat landing, which is a good starting point for walking, because it will give us several options for scenery and distance. We park and set off down a pleasantly shabby wooded lane. Govinda produces a small bundle of folded cash from his shirt pocket and hands it to me. "You put $171 in the can," he explains. "I kept 10, which still makes you our largest contributor." "I was a little tired," I explain. "I was pretty eager to get out of there." "Yeah, I think we noticed." We walk in silence for a while. "I didn't track you down just to return the money," he says. I wait. "I read your book," he says. "I got a preview copy from Mark. I read it, I don't know, like 5 times. It's all dog-eared and highlighted. It's really great, really. I read a lot." "That louse," I exclaim. "He was supposed to be there that night. And now he's revealing my secret identity and my hidden lair." "I guess his grandmother died that night. She'd been sick." "Oh," I reply. "A death in the family. The king of excuses. Shame to waste it on me." "And I think I'm the only one he told about you." "So I shouldn't expect any more surprise visits?" "No, not that I know of. I don't think so." "Good. It's not my house. I can't let it turn into a whole weird thing out here." "Look, I hope you don't mind." "Don't worry about it," I say. But I'm a little worried about it. And already my thoughts are turning back to the charming, ego-free zone I maintained in Morocco. We veer off the lane onto a sandy shoreline path. "I want to know why Arjuna fell," he says. "What you mean is, you want to know why Arjuna got back up, and you realize that you must first know why he fell." He thinks about that for a minute. "Yes, I guess so." "What to do? What to do?" "Kill Krishna. Kill Arjuna. That's the first thing Govinda needs. He's stuck on the Gita, and we have to get him unstuck." "You know," I tell him, "Arjuna wasn't like you. He wasn't a seeker, a spiritual guy. He wasn't a student of philosophy or truth. His experience with Krishna in the Gita was not the result of his own effort or intent. He didn't become truth realized through his own processes. He got a free pass, revealed by mystic spell. Krishna cheated, as Krishna will do. He picked Arjuna up in a helicopter, gave him the grand tour, and set him back down, all in order to get Arjuna to do what he, Krishna, wanted done." "I haven't really thought about it that way before," he says. "The Bhagavad Gita really isn't worth much. I like it, but it's not of much practical value to anyone who wants to wake up. It has a few good points, but it's much more effective at conveying duality than non-duality. For Arjuna, truth realization is a temporary phenomenon. He wakes up enough to do as Krishna wishes, and then he returns to his ordinary dream state. His non-dual awareness was non-abiding." Govinda is silent, contemplative. "If you want to see a guy getting back up, read Moby Dick." I bring up Moby Dick because it applies, and it's on my mind, and because I like talking things through to see them better for myself. Here's Captain Ahab, right? Before his first meeting with Moby Dick, he's still got both legs, still a normal, respectable guy, right? He's a ship's captain, a trusted career man from Nantucket, a husband, and a father. He's made his life whaling, which is the business of Nantucket. He's a Quaker, which is the religion of Nantucket. We don't really know much about why he fell, but we see him when he gets back up. He's out in the middle of the ocean, maybe a few years since he set foot on solid ground. He's in the middle of a fierce fight with a huge, white-headed whale. Picture it. He and his men are in small, fragile whaleboats engaged in a raging battle. The boats are smashed and splintered. The water is churned white with froth and red with blood from the thrashing leviathan. Leviathan, enemy of light. Tangled lines and floating debris everywhere. Men thrashing in the water, yelling over the din. Boats crushed. And at the center of it all, a frenzied beast the size of a house fighting for its life. Pretty hairy, huh? Govinda grunts. So, the whale is winning. The boats that were launched to kill him are smashed. The bloody churning water is strewn with ropes and splintered wood and crewmen. And what does Ahab do? Govinda shakes his head. He grabs a 6-inch knife and attacks the whale, like a child attacking a sumo wrestler with a thumbtack. He hurls himself at the whale and tries to kill it with a knife. Christ! What a thing to do, right? What is it that built up in him for how long to make him do something like that? Who knows? But he did. What happens? The whale bites off his leg. Ouch. That's where the line is crossed. That's the division between two things. That kind of battle wasn't unusual in whaling. Boats get busted up, men end up in the water, whales get away with harpoons and lances in them. A captain of Ahab's experience would have seen a similar scene dozens of times, maybe hundreds. Really? But this time, it's different. This time, there's something in Ahab that won't be turned back. Who knows what or why? Ahab has no prior relationship to this whale. It should be just another whale to him. But this time, Ahab grabs a knife and hurls himself at the whale. And from the exact instant when that impulse went forth from his brain on its way to his legs and arms, one thing was over, and another thing had begun. We walk for a while in silence. The Gita is still a valuable tool, I eventually continue. But if you look at it as some sort of sacred text, or as some divine, unimpeachable authority, you'll be making the only real mistake you can. Stopping, he says. Yes, it's all about moving forward. Nothing is sacred or holy or divine, only true or not. So, you want to know why Arjuna fell? Well, you don't, really. But I know what you mean. You want to climb out of this hole you've spent 15 years digging yourself into and take the journey you've been avoiding. Sound about right? He winces and nods. Yes. Cool. Well, there's reason to be optimistic. I don't always know what tune the universe is playing, but it's definitely playing one now. We've been brought together through some pretty unlikely circumstances, and I don't know why, but there are reasons. Maybe it's for you. Maybe it's for the book I'm working on, or maybe something else. All of the above, probably. Who knows? Doesn't matter. The reasons are always there, whether we see them or not. We continue walking for another hour or so, during which time I begin to understand something that's not easy for me to understand. I let Govinda do most of the talking, while I just walk, my mind in neutral, and the thing that starts to become clear to me is that the whole releasing the tiller thing I talked about in Damnedest has not gotten through to him. Maybe he thought it was optional, a step that could be skipped. Listening to him talk, it seems that he's simply ignoring it, and this, right here, is the really weird thing about working with spiritual seekers. They will do anything and everything necessary to make the journey, except move. They're totally committed to going, as long as they can stay right where they are. They would give anything to be there, as long as they can do it from here. Ego wants the goodies, so if the price of the goodies is ego, what's the point? It doesn't make much sense to trade your horse for a saddle. So what's the solution? You can have your cake and eat it too. This is the best-selling formula that had Govinda marching in place for 15 years. The promise that one can soar majestically as an eagle without actually leaving the nest. Virtual reality, I guess. Virtual spirituality. Virtual life. I finally had to stop reading spiritual books and magazines several years ago when it became embarrassingly apparent that this same formula, endlessly rehashed, formed the basis upon which the entire spiritual marketplace thrives. The last thing of a spiritual nature I recall reading was a magazine interview with an old Indian guy who said that if I recited a certain mantra for 6 months, I'd get rich, or if I stood on hot rocks for 6 months, I'd conquer my sexual desires, and if I lived on air alone for 6 months, I'd get enlightened. I wondered if all three could be done simultaneously so I could be a rich, enlightened eunuch in time for the holidays, but the article didn't address that. Rather than risk a really shitty 6 months with nothing, or just the eunuch part, to show for it, I bid farewell to my days as an interested observer of human spirituality and haven't looked back. What I'm noticing about Govinda is something that's been bubbling up in my awareness all week, and now it's coming to the surface. Julie talked about it in some of her emails that I've recently read. That got me watching Mary and Curtis and some other people to see how they operated. Now Govinda is here, and I'm really starting to see that the most basic yet most important thing is the least recognized. And not the most important thing just in the waking up sense, but in the sweet dreams sense as well. And the reason I may be slow in realizing this is because the quality to which I refer has been so fully integrated in me for so long that I assume it's shared by all, or I've forgotten that it's not. That, or due to my ego-shunning lifestyle of late, I've simply managed to block it out. This may be the point of this whole curious chain of events, starting with my poor sleep the night before heading into the city, Megan's Be Here Now remix, the Gita meeting in Queens, the talk on the beach with Curtis, Govinda tracking me down and showing up in person, and who knows what's next. Foolish to pretend to know where anything begins or ends, of course, but handy to isolate smaller trends in order to guess at larger patterns. The point of this chain of events certainly doesn't have to be just one thing, like me realizing that I have a blind spot regarding other people's mastery of higher navigation, or that many people are living their own lives as impartial observers. It can also be, and certainly is, about Govinda and his progress, and I'm sure there are many other threads woven into this small section of the tapestry as well. Infinite intelligence means just that. As vast and incomprehensibly complex as the workings of things may appear to us, there is no such thing as big or small, simple or hard, many or few, to the perfect intelligence that governs all and is all. And I think the thing I might have failed to notice is the fact that not everyone knows this and lives their life in accordance with it. I think the thing I might have forgotten along the way is that most people, including many of those around me, operate from the level of the finite brain rather than infinite mind. So there's the next piece in this ever-unfolding puzzle. It has somehow escaped my notice that most people function at an immeasurably inferior manner than that which is rightly theirs. Beggars with a winning lottery ticket in an unchecked pocket. This isn't really an enlightenment thing so much as a human development thing. This was discussed in Damnedest, but it can't be overemphasized. Not mine, but thy will be done. The will of Allah. Brahma is the charioteer. If you don't get this, you don't get anything. If this isn't your living reality, then you are, like most people, stuck in the ego-clad, nestling state. If so, my advice is this. Observe the state. Make a study of it as it appears in yourself and others. Turn the light of your mind upon it. See it everywhere. Learn to recognize the workings and reasonings of ego. Dissect thoughts, words, and actions to find the kernel of fear within. To know the lie is to hate it. To see it is to slay it. There is no nobility in spiritual poverty. If you desire release from this state, you should pray for it. If you don't desire release from this state, you should pray for the desire. The nest isn't life, as anyone who has taken wing will attest. Enlightenment, a fancy word for awake, is for every single person to arrive at eventually, whereas this higher, unbounded mode of being is here and now for whoever truly wants it. If you made a wish list of anything and everything you could ever want from spiritual pursuits and practices, human adulthood would fulfill it or provide the means. Of course, most people are hopelessly locked into their lives, and that's why something so natural and universally desirable is so rare. But there it is. Most people stop growing at around the age of 10 or 12 and die in the nest they were born in. It would be easy to believe that many, if not most, of the woes of mankind, on both the individual and societal levels, stem from this state of arrested development. Yes, it's as true of society as of the individuals that make up society. Look for yourself. Look at yourself. Look at the news, at politics, at religion. Look at education, healthcare, business, entertainment. Look at the why and the why of the why. All you'll see is greed and vanity, the offspring of fear. All fear being, ultimately, the fear of no self. Thumb through any magazine. Flip through the channels of the TV. Go wherever there are people, and you'll see nothing but a morbidly juvenile, fear-infected, stunted, runtish race over which Maya reigns supreme and unchallenged. It's not that a better way is available and that most people fail to take advantage of it, but that a better way is at all times in full force and effect. And to function from the level of the puny separate self is to work in opposition to it. In other words, it works in our lives not to the degree that we harness it or master it, but to the degree that we get out of its way. It's really nothing more than coming of age, of fully developing into our own potential. You'd think it would be the primary subject in every home and school, but most adults are just children who don't know their children, unwittingly perpetuating an endless cycle of complacent mediocrity. Believing themselves fully and normally developed, they raise their children to become adults who don't know their children, passing the torch of spiritual dwarfism on to the next generation, who will pass it on to the next. We hope that our children might grow up to be president, or a rich doctor, or a powerful lawyer, as if that were any sort of success. Rather, we should hope that they grow up to be grown-up human beings and redefine our notions of success accordingly. The prison door of self is never closed, but very few wish to walk through it. The chains that confine us in Plato's cave are not locked, but very few are aware of their captive status. Those who have slipped their chains may be more effectively confined yet, thinking themselves free merely because their cell is larger and others are less free. Thinking themselves free, they don't seek freedom. They are content in their captivity. I think of people I know and have known, and I'm forced to concede that this fuller development I'm talking about isn't so much good or bad as something that's right when it's right. It's something for people to worry about when they get to it, and not before. Juvenile rambunctiousness provides the dramatic element of life. After all, what fun is a playground full of well-behaved adults? Pride, envy, gluttony, lust, anger, greed, sloth. The seven deadly sins, like it or not, are the spice of life. Maybe there's a choice about things, and maybe there's not, but we're acting like there is, so why not choose not to choose? The confines of self can be heaven or hell, and there's no sense in clawing your way out of heaven. When heaven becomes hell, as all heavens must, that open door will start looking pretty good. Until that time, we lack the motivation necessary to pass through it anyway. The point of the advice I gave above, pray, is to make that time come sooner. Is that good advice? I don't know. I think of Henry and his friends with their special blend spirituality, and how events conspired to make me visit them in their cells and mouth off like I knew what they needed. But what they needed was what they already had. The point of a dream is to dream, not to wake up. Their lives would suffocate me in a minute, but they live them comfortably, happily. So why mess with that? That's why I make a point of not visiting people in their cells. If they want to step out, they can. When they want to, they will. If they have questions and know how to ask, the answers will come. Now you, on the other hand, reading this book, might take a moment to consider how your thread weaves through this section of the tapestry. It's our little conceit that we possess free will, so you might want to exert some now. You have either left your cell already, or you're sniffing around at the open door, so this might be a good time to stop and ask yourself what you want and what you're willing to give for it. Not all fires are started by conscious intent, according to convenient schedules. Sometimes they just flare up where you didn't even know it was getting warm. And then you learn two things fast. Fire doesn't negotiate, and nothing doesn't burn. What do you really want? If you've got the kids, and the house, and the cars, and the career, or any sort of life you're fond of, and you're looking at the subjects discussed here as a way to spiritually enhance your existing lifestyle, then I should remind you that dreams are highly flammable things, and I suggest that you ask yourself, really ask yourself, why you're reading books about setting your world on fire. Whoever battles monsters should take care not to become a monster too, for if you stare long enough into the abyss stares also into you. Friedrich Nietzsche. Chapter 21. The First Step. His three boats stove around him, and oars and men both whirling in the eddies. One captain, seizing the line knife from his broken prow, had dashed at the whale, as an Arkansas duelist at his foe, blindly seeking with a 6-inch blade to reach the fathom-deep life of the whale. That captain was Ahab. Herman Melville. Moby Dick. The first step, however one comes to it, marks the end of one thing and the start of another. Until the first step is taken, awakening from the dream state isn't possible. After the first step is taken, staying in the dream state isn't possible. When we are first introduced to Ahab, he is already beyond the first step, but Ishmael recounts the early effects of it for us. It is not probable that this monomania in him took its instant rise at the precise time of his bodily dismemberment. Then, in darting at the monster, knife in hand, he had but given loose to a sudden, passionate, corporal animosity, and when he received the stroke that tore him, he probably but felt the agonizing bodily laceration, but nothing more. Yet, when by this collision forced to turn towards home, and for long months of days and weeks, Ahab and anguish lay stretched together in one hammock, rounding in midwinter that dreary, howling Patagonian cape. Then it was that his torn body and gashed soul bled into one another, and so interfusing, made him mad. That it was only then, on the homeward voyage, after the encounter, that the final monomania seized him, seems all but certain from the fact that, at intervals during the passage, he was a raving lunatic and, though unlimbed of a leg, yet such vital strength yet lurked in his Egyptian chest and was moreover intensified by his delirium that his mates were forced to lace him fast, even there, as he sailed, raving in his hammock. In a straitjacket, he swung to the mad rockings of the gales. Whatever it was in Ahab that made him grab a knife and make that leap in a hopelessly futile bid to kill the whale didn't just appear in him at that moment. There are hinted presaging events, but in that act Ahab expressed his intent. He told the universe, in the only language the universe understands, what he wanted. He made a wish, and now he gets what he wished for. So it begins. An interesting question is whether Ahab chose his destiny, or it chose him. From the knife passage, it might seem that he was just a whaling captain who was going about his normal business when the first step struck him like a bolt from the blue, hit him like a bus. However, we see that there was something in Ahab before that turning point that makes it unclear where the line between volition and fate is really drawn when it comes to the first step, or anything else for that matter. It didn't come upon him during his raving madness while lashed in a swaying hammock for long months of days and weeks after he lost his leg. It may look black and white, as if a sane, responsible man suddenly snapped in the heat of battle, but Melville hints at a series of grays leading up to it, things involving fire and sacraments and the mysterious Parsees and Fadala. In terms of Plato's cave allegory, by the time Ahab made his lunge at the whale, he had long since rejected one layer of reality and was now declaring war on another. He had already slipped his chains and quietly explored the cave. Now, with the first step, he was rejecting the cave itself and bolting for the exit. The first step has now been taken, and the shearing away of the self begins with an initial impact of such enormity that Ahab is profoundly and forever changed. After taking that first step, Ahab, as is certain to occur, has a piece of himself torn away, a piece that can never heal, never grow back. And then it was that, suddenly sweeping his sickle-shaped lower jaw beneath him, Moby Dick had reaped away Ahab's leg as a mower a blade of grass in the field. End of Disc 5.